A good union is one where the members feel like the union belongs to them because it does belong to them, and where the union is not just something that happens at the union hall, much less that something where its lobbyists are going to the state legislature. The union is something that people can feel every day at work.
Herzlich willkommen bei What's Left, dem linken Podcast zur US-Wahl. Eine Koproduktion der Schweizer Wochenzeitung WOTS und der deutschen Monatszeitung Analyse und Kritik. Mein Name ist Lukas Hermsmeier, ich arbeite als freier Journalist in New York und ich werde bis November mit verschiedenen Gästen über die dringendsten Themen dieses Landes sprechen. Am 1. Oktober, also vor 2 Wochen, gingen in den USA zehntausende HafenarbeiterInnen in den Streik. Weil diese Industrie so zentral ist, schaltete sich sofort die Biden-Regierung ein. Nach wenigen Tagen gaben die Hafenbetreiber dem massiven Druck der Streikenden nach. Es wurde sich auf einen neuen Vertrag geeinigt mit einer Gehaltserhöhung von über 60%, ein signifikanter Sieg für die Dockworkers also. Arbeitskämpfe wie dieser haben in den USA zugenommen. Nach Jahrzehnten des Niedergangs der Gewerkschaftsbewegung ist ein Aufschwung zu spüren, zumindest in bestimmten Branchen. Neue Gewerkschaften haben sich geformt, zum Beispiel bei Amazon und Starbucks. Alte Gewerkschaften haben sich von innen reformiert. Vorneweg die United Auto Workers. Und auch innerhalb der amerikanischen Gesellschaft hat sich etwas getan. Laut aktueller Studien sind 70% der Bevölkerung Gewerkschaften gegenüber positiv eingestellt. So hoch war die Zustimmung zuletzt in den 60er Jahren. Wie erklärt sich dieser Wandel? Was zeichnet die neuen Arbeitskämpfe aus? Und auf welche Weise nehmen Gewerkschaften Einfluss auf die Politik, den Wahlkampf? Darüber spreche ich heute mit der Journalistin Jane Slaughter, die in der Gewerkschaftswelt, das kann man ohne Übertreibung so sagen, eine Legende ist. Jane Slaughter gehörte 1979 zu den Gründerinnen von Labor Notes, bis heute eine der wichtigsten Plattformen der Gewerkschaftsbewegung. Labor Notes publiziert nicht nur Artikel, sondern veranstaltet auch Workshops, Konferenzen, macht politische Bildungsarbeit. Hier läuft also vieles zusammen. Jane wohnt in Detroit und war in den vergangenen 5 Jahrzehnten bei unzähligen Arbeitskämpfen live dabei. Wenn jemand wie sie sagt, dass sie noch nie so viel Enthusiasmus gespürt hat wie in den vergangenen Jahren, dann bedeutet das was. Hier kommt Jane Slaughter. Hello, Jane. Welcome to the podcast.
I'm happy to be here.
Jane, if we look back at the last 5 to 10 years, there has been a pretty remarkable revitalization of the labor movement in the US. We've seen new unions forming in places like Amazon and Starbucks. We've seen old unions becoming more militant. And we've seen also an increase of strikes, at least in certain industries. We've seen more media coverage of labor struggles. What would you say are the main factors for these developments, for the revitalization of the labor movement, in very broadly speaking?
There's a number of things that have happened. One is the campaign of Bernie Sanders for president in 2016 and 2020 helped to open up people's minds to some degree to what might be possible and a more radical analysis of what society is about and who deserves what. So that would be one thing. Another, the pandemic made a lot of people angry when they saw how workers were treated. You know, the whole way that people were described as essential workers, and yet management didn't want to give them raises, didn't care if they came to work and got sick. They were treated very badly. So especially among hospital workers and factory workers, farm equipment workers, for example, were called essential workers. They had to come to work during the pandemic. They felt that a lot. And another thing, though, would be, and this is not exactly related to the other things, is the rise of reform movements in certain unions that might have been there for a while, but they became stronger more recently. So we're talking about the Teamsters, the auto workers, the teachers' unions, the fact that people were organizing in their locals to change their unions to make them more militant. That definitely contributed to this revitalization.
So it's a product of long-term organizing. I definitely want to talk about that more.
But before that, I would like to get a better sense for like what has happened maybe in the society at large, right? We've seen also an increase of approval within the US population, right? Like more and more people are in favor of unions. I think it's 70% now. It hasn't been more than that, like in 60 years. Would you say that approval of unions in general reflects a new class consciousness, or is that a bit of a stretch to say that?
I think it's a little bit of a stretch. It's a good thing, obviously, but it probably doesn't reflect class consciousness in the sense that you and I might like to see that fully formed. But as I was saying before, more of a consciousness of we are getting screwed. Mm-hmm. And to some degree, not completely by any means, more of a sense of who that we is and who the we is as opposed to the people at the top that are screwing us. I think it's in that latter definition where people get more confused. Sometimes they want to punch down rather than punching up.
Mm-hmm. And you've seen a more productive understanding, like who is actually the reason why people are earning little, etc.
Yes, but it's mixed. As you know, many people want to blame anything bad that happens to them on immigrants, which is completely illogical. But it's much easier to blame people who don't have any power than to blame people who seem to have all the power, your own employer.
Totally. One thing I already mentioned briefly is the formation of new unions, right? In places like Amazon, Starbucks, Trader Joe's. Would you say, again, very broadly speaking now, are these unions that have been formed after decades in some cases where the companies really, really successfully try to suppress them and avoided the formation of unions, do these unions work very differently than the old ones? Do we see not only the fact that there are new unions, but also different kind of union work?
Not all the time, to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
When the Amazon labor union was formed a couple of years ago, it shocked everyone because it did seem to come out of nowhere. It was organized independently of any union, just workers themselves organizing themselves. All the old labor hands were quite shocked that this was even possible.
Yeah.
So, yes.
And that was in 2022.
Correct.
In Staten Island.
Yes.
Island, one of the boroughs.
Yes,
in New
just
York.
Yeah. One warehouse, but it was a very large warehouse. Starbucks, some similarities there, but Starbucks was a campaign and is a campaign of a very large, very traditional union, the service employees, which has lots of workers in the service sector, and has traditionally been a very top-down union, very staff-run. However, it looks like the Starbucks organizing has been permitted to be more worker-led, more worker-to-worker contacts, workers training other workers how to organize their stores. So in that sense, yes, there has been some difference. And as I'm sure you know, of course, now, the Amazon labor union, the one in Staten Island, has joined the Teamsters. What is that going to mean? Will that be only a boon to them, or we don't know?
Are you optimistic? Because that is such an interesting development, right? We have this grassroots union, as you were describing it, very much led by the workers themselves, joining all this massive ship of a union. Are you hopeful about that development?
I think it's basically a good thing because they were not able to bring Amazon to the bargaining table. They do not have a contract. Amazon is just stalled and stalled using every means of the bad labor laws to its advantage. And so they wanted to ally with someone who, number one, has more resources. They've got all the media, the lawyers, the staff organizer help, everything that they might need, but also that is trying to organize Amazon in many, many other places. And the Labor Notes actually has just published a good article about all the many places in where both warehouse workers and delivery drivers for Amazon have been organizing, and the Teamsters is the main union doing that.
Mm. You were mentioning this like big hype in 2022 when the first warehouse, the first Amazon warehouse in the US, decided to join a union or to form a union. And since then, it has been like 2.5 years now almost, there has been no contract, there has been no, they haven't been able to get to the bargaining table. Do you often think that is like underestimated as a step? People are very, very excited when it comes to the formation of a union, but then don't understand how much it takes to actually get a new contract?
Yes, I think certainly in the general public, that wouldn't be well understood. People who are seasoned union organizers understand it very well, that the employer will resist very much giving anything up at the bargaining table, or sometimes even coming to the bargaining table. And our labor law says that if you don't get a contract within 1 year, then the employer can try to organize the workers to vote against the union and kick it out altogether. And they do that sometimes. So the law allows the employers to appeal everything that happens through the courts and to stall and stall and challenge the results of the union, and then again to stall at the bargaining table.
And so much of the situation still in the U.S. When it comes to laws, when it comes to like established forces, is still hostile towards unions. Why? That's why at the same time we have a revitalization, the situation overall is very grim. Why? 10% of workers in the US are only unionized. Especially in the South, there are laws that make it very difficult for unions to work, to organize, to do anything. Are you, if you like try to balance these both things, right? Like the positive developments and then the grim situation, are you still very pessimistic or optimistic? Is that possible for you to say?
Well, I'm more optimistic just because of the enormous amounts of activity that we've seen lately, including very militant activity, people willing to go on strike, which, as you said, is different from 10 years ago. So that's got to be a positive sign. It doesn't mean that every battle is going to win. But Lucas, I never have seen so much enthusiasm in the labor movement as I saw when the United Auto Workers were taken over by reformers and then went on a big 6-week strike a year ago. People throughout the labor movement were just ecstatic about that. So things like that, and I could name others, tends to make us more optimistic without discounting the fact that our enemies are still very strong.
Yeah. And we will come back to the United Auto Workers because that is a very, very specific situation and like specifically hopeful. I would like to go back a little bit in time. You co-founded an organization called Labor Notes, and it was in 1979, so a few years ago, which it has become and was for the last decades one of the most important organizations within the labor movement. Could you explain a little bit what you were doing maybe at the time before you founded that and what led to the founding of Labor Notes? What was the purpose to do that back in 1979?
Well, Jimmy Carter was president. A recession was looming. Unions were 23.4% of the workforce, so more than twice as much as now. The employers actually behaved then as if unions had a right to exist. If you had a union contract, they would come to the table and they would bargain every 3 years a better contract. And people expected that their wages would go up over time, and they did. Immigration was not an issue that anybody was thinking about. So it was sort of a staid, sort of boring labor movement in many ways, except in some quarters, there was a whole bunch of rank and file agitation in the steel workers, in the auto workers, in the coal miners, and in the Teamsters. Workers were doing all sorts of militant things. In the miners, they had literally thousands of wildcat strikes, that is, illegal strikes during the term of the contract. In the auto workers, there was a rank and file reform movement, same thing in the steelworkers, where they were trying to change their leadership and get the right to vote on their contracts. In the Teamsters, there were also wildcat strikes and also trying to battle for control of the union. So Labornut's idea was to try to bring those people who were all fighting in their separate unions more together and to help them see themselves as part of a current in the labor movement that had similar ideas. That these days in labor notes, we call it the troublemaking wing of the labor movement. We didn't have that phrase then, but we wanted people to be able to see themselves in other people. We started holding conferences where they could meet each other in person. You know, of course, in 1979, the means of communication were so much less than there was now. People were depending on our hard copy, paper monthly newsletter that we set out. There was no digital communication. So again, an attempt to help people to see themselves as part of this current in the labor movement that was trying to change it and fight the boss.
And what are the pillars of Labornut's now? You already mentioned the conference that is still happening and has become even more important. And I will ask you in a few minutes about the last conference that was very special. But like, what is Labornut's doing besides conferences?
Okay, the conference is every 2 years. Mm-hmm. And then we have about maybe a dozen or more local conferences every year in different cities. We call them troublemaker schools, and they're like a smaller version of the big conference, you know, somewhere between maybe 150 and 400 people that come and get the same sorts of workshops and the same sorts of educational talks. Then we have online workshops just all the time. Every month we're doing our series called Secrets of a Successful Organizer. We do one called When Your Union Breaks Your Heart, which is about how to reform your union. We do one specially for stewards. We do one called Race and Labor. So those are going on all the time. And then we're just also constantly putting out content, both in the print newsletter and in the, you know, on our website. Just lots and lots of news and analysis about what's happening. For example, we've got lots of detail about what's happening at Boeing. If you want to know why these airplane workers are going on strike, Labornut's is where you'll find it.
And were you hoping back then, in 1979, that Labornut's becomes what it has become? Or was the idea very different? Or was there even an idea?
Well, I do think it's somewhat similar, although, of course, we had no idea that the internet would be invented.
Yeah. Fair enough.
But yes, the politics of Labornut's have stayed very much the same over the past 45 years. And this, again, it's like creating for people a way to learn how to be a better fighter and to meet other people who are doing so.
Mm-hmm. You already briefly described the political situation in the late 70s. Jimmy Carter was president. And in many ways, it was also the beginning, I guess, of an era we could describe as a neoliberal era, right? Like where
yes,
privatizations and deregulations started very heavily. But yeah, if you have thoughts on that, I would like to hear about that. But also if you compare just the class composition in the US, like what was the working class in the 70s compared to now? What would be the biggest differences?
Well, the composition of the labor movement, that is organized workers, has changed in that the proportion of public employees to private sector is much greater now. There's, I believe, five times as many union members are public employees as are private employers. It's something like 35% of the public employee workforce and only 6% of the private sector, which when I say it just sounds so shocking.
And many of the public employers are teachers, right?
Teachers and people who work for cities, you know, doing the garbage pickup and administrative things, yes. lots of teachers.
Mm-hmm.
So when Labor Notes started, most of the interesting action, the things that I described to you before, was happening in the blue-collar private sector workforce, miners, teamsters, auto workers, steel workers, sometimes others, and less was happening in terms of public employees. And then, I won't say starting in 2018, but with a major explosion in 2018, we saw teachers suddenly moving to the front of the line. With in 2018 and 2019, there were at least six big strikes of teachers all across the country. And all of a sudden, they were, you know, the leading edge of the labor movement. I think that changed during the pandemic, and now we're seeing the blue-collar workers come to the fore a little bit more.
For example, the Amazon warehouse workers, right?
Yes, and the Boeing workers, and the dock workers who just settled their strike on
the
East Coast.
Yeah, had a 3-day long strike, right? And achieved a pretty significant raise in salaries, right?
A big raise, which they badly needed because their wages were low.
Yeah.
$6 an hour to start off with and $24 an hour over the course of 6 years. But what they put in abeyance is the whole question of automation. And I hope the union is sincere about this. Their president has said, no, we are not done. We're only suspending the strike until after the election, essentially, until January 15th, when they will be free to strike again over the question of automation, which has drastically cut the number of dock worker jobs that exist, especially on the West Coast. So I really commend them for wanting to, you know, not just take the money and settle the contract quickly and saying, it's all over. They're saying, no, we still have the chance to come back and do this again in January.
Jane, you have published so many articles in the last decades about labor struggles, and you also edited a book called A Troublemaker's Handbook. I think it came out in 2005, right?
Yes.
Would you say, and this book is about different methods and strategies and, a reflection of what happened back then, almost 20 years ago, in the labor movement. Would that book look very differently today if you published a book about labor organizing? Have methods changed a lot, or are like the key pillars and basics pretty much the same?
I would say more the same than different.
Mm-hmm.
If we were publishing a third edition of Troublemaker's Handbook, we would come up with lots of newer examples. But people still tend to do a lot of the same things when they go on strike, and many of the same things when they're building up to a strike with a contract campaign. Of course, there would be a lot more digital content.
Yeah.
Much more about how you use Facebook, which is surprisingly important.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure I don't know. I'd like to hear what somebody else would say to answer this question, Lucas, because I would tend toward more the methods have stayed the same, but I don't know if everybody would agree with that.
Because I assume when it comes to organizing a workplace, building trust among workers, building relationships, that has not changed, right? This is still the key.
Absolutely. And I'm glad you mentioned that because sometime next year, early next year, I hope, we're going to be publishing a new book that really emphasizes that question, the question of relationships and how you build respectful relationships with your coworkers and how that's the basis of everything. And it's a stage that just can't be skipped. I have seen so many workers who would prefer not to talk to their fellow coworkers because it's hard. It can be contentious. They would like to leave the flyers on the break room table rather than have a face-to-face conversation with anybody. But you're 100% right. It all has to be based on building relationships of trust.
Would it be possible for you to to briefly say what a good union, when a union is a good union, what makes the union a good union?
You didn't tell me that question ahead of time. A good union is one where the members feel like the union belongs to them because it does belong to them, and where the union is not just something that happens at the union hall, much less that something where its lobbyists are going to the state legislature. The union is something that people can feel every day at work. In the workplace, you feel like you can defend your rights because you have a union and because your coworkers will back you up. That's a good union.
Eine gute Gewerkschaft, sagt Jane Slaughter, zeichnet sich dadurch aus, dass sie von den Mitgliedern selbst angetrieben wird. Das klingt eigentlich simpel, ist aber eben doch die Ausnahme, denn in vielen Gewerkschaften gibt es eine deutliche Trennung zwischen Funktionären und Beschäftigten. Besonders interessant ist deshalb, was in den vergangenen 2 Jahren bei den United Auto Workers passiert ist. Eine Gewerkschaft, die lange Zeit korrupt war und konservativ geführt wurde und nun so etwas wie die Speerspitze der ArbeiterInnenbewegung ist. Wie es dazu gekommen ist, erklärt Jane in der 2. Hälfte unseres Gespräches. Und es geht auch um die aktuelle politische Situation.
Der What's Left Podcast zu den US-Wahlen ist eine Co-Produktion der Schweizer Wochenzeitung What's und der deutschen Monatszeitung Analyse und Kritik. Beide Redaktionen haben Personal und Zeit investiert. Finanziert wird der Podcast vom Recherchierfonds ProWatts. Wenn Sie mithelfen wollen, dass Projekte dieser Art auch in Zukunft umgesetzt werden können, spenden Sie auf prowatts.ch und abonnieren Sie eine oder gleich beide Zeitungen.
Let's talk about the United Auto Workers a little bit, the union you already mentioned and have been following and writing about for many years. So, yeah, it's arguably one of the most important unions in the US right now. They elected a new leadership in 2023, Sean Fain, who has made a significant number of headlines with like very militant speeches. They also went on strike last year, achieved a new contract, including better wages, more protection, and some job security also in the transition towards electric vehicles, right? And you also already in the very beginning of our conversation mentioned the importance of reform caucuses within unions, right? So like what are the main factors that this union, the United Auto Workers, that was for a long time a pretty corrupt conservative organization is now a militant force? What has happened there?
It was a lucky combination of circumstances. Some people who had been dissidents, reformers in the union for a while, decided in 2019 to start a new organization specifically with the purpose of trying to win the right for members to vote on their own top officers. In the UAW and many other unions, this happens at a convention rather than going out to all the members.
And these were mainly auto workers?
Yes,
like
yes.
They worked in like General Motors, Ford.
Oh, yes, yeah. Definitely. Mm-hmm. The two main ones that I'm thinking of worked at Ford and General Motors. So they formed this caucus, and it had, to my mind, surprising success in getting a number of different locals to pass resolutions saying, we want a special convention to change the Constitution so that we can make this change that the members have the right to vote on their officers. But it was a very convoluted process, very bureaucratic, hard to achieve. It would have been difficult for them to go all the way to achieving their goal through those constitutional methods. But then someone in the union, I believe, called the Justice Department and told them about all the corruption that was going on in the union, that is the U.S. Justice Department, part of the administration. And they began an investigation, and they did indeed find lots of corruption, embezzlement, just stealing money from the members. They got people indicted, and 13 top officers of the union were sent to jail. Very unusual. But because this reform movement, which was called Unite All Workers for Democracy, UAWD, Because that existed, they were able to intervene with the Justice Department and say, we know the solution to this union's problems. Let the members have the right to vote. And they campaigned hard for that. They had a vote on whether to have the right to vote. And the members said, yes, we want the right to vote. And this was all because of the organizing of UAWD, the reform movement. The old guard was organizing against it, of course. So once they won the right to vote, they put up a slate for the executive board of the union, and all of their candidates won, which was pretty amazing. And that's when they set to work trying to change things. And that was only a few months before the big contracts with the big three automakers, Ford, General Motors, and Stellantis, were going to expire. So they had to work very quickly to try to get the members on board that we're going to have a strike that wins this time, not a strike that's just for nothing.
So in the beginning of this process, or like the key element of this development, is a democratization, right? Like to make yes. sure that a union, as you already mentioned, like a good union is a union that is workers-led and where like people feel being part of that every day. That happened within the United Auto Workers, that people got a voice.
Well, I don't want to exaggerate this, because things go up and they go down. And many, many members still think of the union as something that is a they. It's something that should do something for them rather than something that they are part of. But the spirit that I witnessed during the strike last year, the 6 weeks that Ford, Chrysler, and Stellantis workers were on strike, was just a monumental change. I had seen workers at General Motors on strike before, and they just sort of stood around glumly and didn't know what the demands were because the union leaders didn't tell them. And they had an idea what they thought they should be striking for, but they didn't win that. But this time around, the pride that the people felt in their union was just inspiring to see. They loved Sean Fain. They loved a guy that was talking tough to the companies and was actually communicating his plans to them. Before there was no, you had no idea what was going on at the bargaining table. This time, Sean Fain would go on Facebook Live every week and report out and say, we got this at General Motors and we got this at Ford. Stellantis is still holding out, so we think we're going to strike Stellantis harder this week. And he would announce the next strike target as a surprise for everybody. So the people loved it. And every local union in the UAW, there's a sort of unofficial Facebook page that they all talk to each other on. So they're all buzzing with this and, of course, talking to each other on the lines. So I would not say, Lucas, that the UAW has been totally transformed. That's not the case. But you could see the beginnings of that in the strike last year.
What makes Sean Fain, the new president, so special? Is it the fearlessness, like his like willingness to be antagonistic? Is it also his down-to-earth attitude or like appearance? He seems to be like a very, very approachable guy, right?
I find him approachable, but yes, it's his fearlessness that, and he has class consciousness. He really gets it about that it's the union's job to represent the members. And he says this over and over again. He always says, not just our own members, we're fighting for the whole working class. And he does not hesitate to call out the capitalists, the owners of the auto companies and all the other companies for what they try to do to workers. He lays it on the line. I really think he's the real deal. It's not just rhetoric.
Mm. I have several friends who came back from the last Labor Notes conference in April this year, it was in Chicago, who came back with being very hyped. They were like, they thought it was the most exciting Labor Notes conference they've ever been to. And I think you would probably agree, but maybe you could describe a little bit what was so special about this conference this year.
Well, part of it was that people were still very hyped by that UAW strike that had happened the previous fall, although this was April, and this change that they were seeing in the UAW. It's just, it's very interesting to me how people always do kind of look to this union, when it's, at least when it's doing something good. So that was part of it. And then the other things that you and I have talked about, the other strikes that have gone on, the new organizing, Amazon, people were also hyped about that. And then there was also just the sheer size, 4,700 people, larger than ever before. And we believe that it could have been 7,000. We had to turn away lots and lots of people. Another thing was the number of young people was great. There were conferences back in the 90s where you did not see a young person. So it was really wonderful to see people, young workers and people who maybe were not working class in their origins, but had decided that the labor movement was where it was at and they wanted to be at Labor Notes.
I would like to talk a little bit about the political situation in the U.S. right now when it comes to labor rights and unions. Joe Biden has been calling himself the most pro-union president in American history. But also, and he's not the only one who has been saying that. Many commentators have emphasized that he has been more pro-union than Barack Obama, for example. Would you agree with that statement? Is he the most pro-union president in your lifetime?
Well, yes, it's a low bar. Obama certainly would not be anybody to measure yourself against. Maybe Franklin Roosevelt, perhaps, would be better. But yeah, Joe Biden, in his appointments to the National Labor Relations Board, the government agency that oversees what unions do and what employers can do, and in his rhetoric, people make a big deal out of his actually walking a few steps on the auto workers' picket line last fall. Obviously, that's completely symbolic, but I'm told that the employers really didn't like it at all. So it was a good symbolic move. And then again, here with the dock workers, the government intervened very strongly to try to tell the employers they had to give some wage increases. Some of these shipping companies, I read, had literally increased their profits by 800% during the pandemic.
Jesus, yeah.
So they were well able to afford some raises for the dock workers. Now, of course, the motivation, I believe, of the administration was that they didn't want a big strike disrupting the economy a month before the election. But still, they intervened and put pressure on the employers and got this very good wage agreement that they got. So, yes, I would say that Joe Biden has been surprisingly pro-union.
Jane, what do you think about Trump's and advances? So, like the Republican candidates' attempts to basically cosplay as workers' advocates, right? They're talking more and more about workers' rights, but also at the same time, obviously, put out policies that are mainly great for very rich people. What do you make out of that?
I think it's absolutely amazing the degree to which they get away with it. How anyone could see Donald Trump as pro-worker just flies in the face of all the facts. Just for example, the National Labor Relations Board that I mentioned earlier, when he was in office, aggressively made all sorts of changes to the law to make it harder for employees to unionize. And the huge tax cuts that he gave to big business, his own background as a billionaire, and J.D. Vance's, he's a Silicon Valley investor. The idea that they can pretend that they're for the little guy is pretty bold. And of course, but they do it, Lucas, by encouraging working people to punch down instead of punch up, and to say that all your problems are caused by these poor people who are coming from other countries looking for a better life, but they're the cause of all your problems. They're poisoning the blood of the nation. And as you know, it's often easier for people to look for a scapegoat and somebody who has less power than they do, rather than looking to the true villains who do have all the power.
When you cover labor struggles and when you go to picket lines or meet up with union people and come across union members that vote for the Republican Party, I don't know how often that happens, but if it and when it happens, do you try to intervene, or do you see yourself more as a journalist who like takes in their thoughts and then writes about it? Is there sometimes like a situation where you try to actually get into a political discussion with union members?
Just yesterday, I was on a picket line with some Teamsters who are striking an oil company. And Bernie Sanders had just visited their picket line. So I asked about that. And the worker I spoke to said, well, he was just doing it for politics because he's against us. And so I said, he's against? Bernie Sanders is very pro-union. He's against big oil. So this worker was identifying the future of the oil industry with his own future for obvious reasons, right? So we had a little conversation about that, and he understood very well that Bernie had been screwed out of the Democratic Party nomination for president. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah.
But he still saw Bernie Sanders as a politician and an enemy of his friend, Big Oil. So this is the kind of thing you run into.
And speaking of the Teamsters, the president of the Teamsters, Sean O'Brien, was one of the speakers in the Republican nomination convention, right, in July. And he was criticized for doing that, for speaking in front of all these Republican politicians, right-wing media forces. And he was like, one of the critiques was that he would normalize this party that has become more and more fascist, basically. Would you agree with the attempt to speak in favor of workers' rights, even in front of Republicans, or are you critical of that decision to speak there?
I think it was a very bad move that encouraged his members who were already Trump backers, and there are quite a few Teamsters who do back Trump. They've done the polls. Rather than trying to educate them and win them over, you put it very well, normalizing the idea that this guy might be on your side. And in his speech, O'Brien pointed to several other Republican politicians that he liked, such as Josh Hawley, who is really one of the worst, because I guess, you know, maybe Hawley's voted right once or twice. But overall, he's extremely anti-worker. So I think it was a very bad move. Many people say it was because so many of his members do back Trump, and he felt like he had to appease them in some way, looking to his next election. That doesn't make sense to me, because I think he has zero chance of not being reelected. So I think it was a bad thing, and I'm glad that he got all the negative feedback that he did. Of course, he also got some positive feedback from his Trump-supporting members who said, thank you.
Yeah. And what would you say is the best way for unions to engage with this election? Is it simply endorsing Kamala Harris and then canvassing for Kamala Harris?
In the absence of other possibilities this year, and given the horribleness of Trump and all the things that he would do to hurt almost everybody, not just in this country, but in the world, I think unions should be out there doing their best to elect Harris, and they are. It's not always the case that members listen to what their union leaders say, but the percentage of union members voting for the Democrats is higher than percentage of other people, generally speaking. So that's what I think they should be doing, and they mostly are.
Mm. And finally, Jane, when it comes to unions and the labor movement, what do you think are we talking about too much? Is there something that is overemphasized in the discourse, in media, in our conversation today, maybe?
Yes, I think we get too excited about certain things that are happening without thinking about the strategic nature. I mean, it's wonderful that graduate students are organizing unions. It's great that Starbucks workers are organizing, but that's coffee shops. It's not the commanding heights of the economy. Let's talk instead about the Teamsters organizing at Amazon. Let's talk about strategy, where we might have power in the big picture of the country. How do we get to the point of exercising that power? Where is our leverage? Which workers' fights have the possibility of influencing other workers to fight and what they can win? And let's talk about how unions need to change to take on challenges like that. How do we get these big, rich, behemoth unions to actually change? So, yeah, instead of just being excited about every little victory that happens, let's try to step back and think more strategically about how do we actually change the balance of power.
Jane, thank you so much for taking the time.
I enjoyed it. Thank you for making me think.
Strategisches Vorgehen, das fordert Jane Slaughter. Anstatt sich an zu vielen Fronten zu verlieren, wäre es besser, wenn die Gewerkschaftsbewegung bestimmte Branchen und Unternehmen priorisiert, vor allem in der Logistik und Produktion, dort also, wo man die Wirtschaft und auch Politik wirklich unter Druck setzen kann. Strategisches Vorgehen verlangt Jane auch mit Blick auf die Wahl im November. Weil Donald Trump die Alternative ist, sollten Gewerkschaften Kamala Harris unterstützen, sagt sie. Es spricht die Erfahrung von vielen Jahrzehnten. In der nächsten Folge von What's Left ist die Historikerin und Autorin Annika Brockschmidt zu Gast. Wir beschäftigen uns mit Trump und der Republikanischen Partei, generell mit der rechten Bewegung in diesem Land und ihren radikalen Plänen. Vielen Dank fürs Zuhören. Dieser Podcast ist eine Koproduktion von der WOTS und Analyse und Kritik, finanziert durch den WOTS Recherchierfonds. Am Podcast beteiligt sind Ua Gültekin, Kaspar Surber, Jan-Ole Arps, Payam Masumi, Helen Derik und Lukas Hermsmeier.